I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 190 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Just remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, what you like about it, what you'd like to improve, maybe some suggested future guests. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor the show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. I am grateful to PRN.fm and its founder, Gary Null, for giving me this opportunity to host the show. And now I'd like to include a message from Gary about how you can support PRN.fm financially.
I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
This week we have some feedback from Joan Shenton, which is kind of ironic because she's one of the guests I interview in this episode. Anyway, she was talking about the story of Raoul, who has been HIV positive for many years following heart surgery after many years of drug abuse, injection drug abuse. Joan said, "What an amazingly moving and inspiring interview. I'm reminded through Raoul's story that Peter Duisberg said so long ago that it was the blood transfusions that Arthur Ashe, the tennis player, had for his heart surgery that would have made him test HIV positive. As we know, Arthur Ashe died from the deadly high doses of AZT, which is a DNA chain terminator and the first AIDS drug ever approved. The high doses of AZT that were prescribed in those days. And now let's go to this week's interview. Meryl Dorey is a mother of four adult children, one of whom was injured by his DPT vaccine first, and then later by his MMR vaccine. These reactions set Meryl on a path to research what she considers to be the three basic questions everyone needs to ask before deciding to accept vaccines. Do they work? Are they safe? Are they necessary? In 1994, she established the Australian Vaccination Risks Network, AVN. It supports the right of all Australians to make free and informed health choices without the fear of coercion, bullying, or financial penalties. They successfully lobbied the federal parliament in 1998 to introduce a conscientious objector clause, legislation which until January 2016 prevented discrimination against the unvaccinated. Sadly, this was overturned in 2016 when the government introduced the no jab, no pay laws. Meryl is hoping for the day when independent research about vaccines and all medical procedures will be funded by the government and laws will be put in place to guarantee medical freedom as a basic and inalienable human right. Joan Shenton has been on the show before and needs no introduction, but now she has another accolade, the most dangerous woman in Australia. Actually, the most dangerous woman they won't let into Australia. The new Ned Kelly, who wields that most dangerous weapon of all, information. Welcome to the show, Meryl and Joan.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, David.
Well, it's good to talk to you both. Let's start with Meryl. How did you hear about Joan's documentary, Sacrificial Virgins, and what made you want to go around Australia showing it?
Well, actually, I can't take credit for this because Alona Lon, who runs a natural immunity community here in Queensland, saw the film and thought it was such an important one that it needed to be aired as widely as possible. And she contacted the ABN and said, can you help us take this message around Australia? And our committee looked at the film and said, this is great. People need to know about this information showing that not only is the human papillomavirus vaccine not effective, but it's also incredibly dangerous. So we decided to help Alona and Joan take this film to as many places as possible.
And Joan, you were supposed to go to Australia. So can you explain why you didn't go in the end?
I can. Can I just quickly add to what Meryl said? I'm also grateful to James Hyams, because it was he that ran the Brisbane Watchdog Film Festival, and he shed light on our film by giving us two awards. Mm-hmm. So I'm really grateful to James for bringing these issues to the fore, and to Meryl for organizing the tour, and etc. And what was the question, David?
Why didn't you go to Australia after all of this preparations?
Oh my goodness. It's this, that I applied late for a visa, but in plenty of time to get an e-visitor visa, electronic visa.
It's supposed to be like 24 hours, right? 24, 48 hours?
I applied 5 days before I was leaving, or was it four? It was five. Five. And I didn't hear from them. And what I did was, and I didn't know that the electronic e-visitor visa actually has two parts. One of them says holiday and business meetings, and the other one says tourism. Well, as I wasn't going to earn any money, and as I was a guest at these screenings, I didn't hit business meetings because I thought that would mean that I'd need another kind of visa, do you see? Mm-hmm. So I hit tourism. Right.
It's confusing because I actually have a little bit of experience because I went to Australia this year on a work visa, which is different than a business visa. For a work visa, you need a letter from an employer and all this kind of stuff, right? And I don't know how much documentation. It took me about 2 months to put the paperwork together and 24 hours to get the visa. But a business meeting visa is the kind of thing, somebody is going to a conference in Australia, they show up with their business visa, and it's essentially a tourist visa. It's just a slightly different category.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what happened was that when I didn't receive it, I started ringing Canberra over and over again. And they said, oh, there's nothing wrong with your paperwork. Everything's fine. And then suddenly they started saying, yes, well, you've been taken out of the automated system and you're now being manually processed.
which seems to be a process that takes a very long time.
Forever. So Merrill did all sorts of things. And then our press release had gone out and the press had been pretty vitriolic. And they'd said I was an anti-vaxxer, that I was, what was the word they used? Horrible words they used about me. I can't remember them now. I always block out what I don't like. And Merrill wrote and complained and all this. And in the end, you know, I still haven't got a visa. But the great thing is that Skype brought us all together, didn't it, Merrill?
It did. You were at every single event, because though the government may be able to keep you physically out of Australia, they cannot stop you from coming in virtually. And your message was heard loud and clear by tens of thousands of Australians, which is fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. So it was kind of one of these things that it seems like somebody in the government was doing just to punish you, but you know, it was a punishment that didn't really have a big effect. No practical effect, although obviously everybody involved would have loved to have Joan in Australia, I'm sure. Meryl, let's go back to you. If you could share your original experience with vaccine damage of one of your children and how that led you from what I assume was a supporter of vaccines to be one of the leading critics in Australia.
Absolutely. When people called me an anti-vaxxer, they couldn't be further from the truth, because I strongly supported vaccination. And when my son had his reactions, he reacted at 2 months. He had high-pitched screaming for hours, and he stopped breathing in his sleep, and he became very ill, wasn't feeding properly. And my doctor was the one who actually told me to leave out the whooping cough portion the next time I had him vaccinated. And then when he got the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, he was hospitalized for 3 days. And that was the last vaccine I gave him. But this was back in 1989 and 1990. And the internet, it existed, but I certainly didn't have access to it. And I felt that it was very unfair that parents like myself were making decisions about vaccination without having access to any information. My doctor never told me anything about side effects, and I thought it was perfectly safe. Only benefits, no risks. So a few years later, after running across many, many families whose children had been seriously affected by vaccines, and one friend of my son's who actually died as a result of seizures caused by vaccines, I got together with a group of health professionals and parents and started the AVN specifically for the purpose of providing information on the other side of the vaccination issue, the one that the government and the medical community tend to either gloss over or suppress completely, so that parents would have an opportunity to make an informed choice for their own families. We certainly never tell anyone not to vaccinate, but we think that vaccines are medical procedures that carry with them real risks, including the risk of death. And parents need to know this beforehand.
I mean, what's interesting, I still remember it was around the year 2000, and I was writing some articles. I sort of fell into writing some articles for an alternative health magazine in Canada. I had offered to write an article on AIDS. And I said something like, you know, AIDS is a huge medical disaster, but there are other parts of medicine like vaccines and antibiotics that work pretty well. And the lady at the magazine just about choked and said, that's not true, you know. And I thought, oh, here's another anti-scientific person. But as time went on, you know, approaching it more from the scientific side, you know, reading things, scientific articles that people would send to me, I started to realize that at the time I made that statement, I knew absolutely nothing about vaccines. Even though I'd studied biology in university, I don't think I'd had 10 seconds on vaccines, except what a wonderful creation they were. So it's interesting that when you actually start to get information, things change. Now, one of the criticisms of vaccine opponents, we have, you know, a mother who had adverse reactions. We have a filmmaker. What about scientific and medical supporters? Can you mention some of those people who've been involved with this process? Either one of you.
Okay.
Yeah. Like Joan, you included some, but Meryl, go ahead.
There are several organizations around the world with physicians and scientists who question the safety of vaccination. There are literally thousands of peer-reviewed articles on vaccine injuries and harm, and also the ineffectiveness of vaccines. Whilst, as you said, your experience before you actually started looking into this, you felt that everyone who questioned vaccines was unscientific and probably not too intelligent. The people in the lay community and the medical community that has not actually done any research for themselves feels the same. I don't know what the medical curriculum is in Canada, but we had a copy of the New South Wales medical curriculum, and in 8 years of university education, there was a half a day on vaccinations, and that half a day did not consist on what vaccines contained or anything to that effect. It was simply telling doctors, you give this vaccine at this time, you give that vaccine at that time, you can give these vaccines together. It was nothing. Doctors in general, if they don't do any research, are less educated about this issue than the average parent who's read a couple of books and has done some research from medical journals.
Yeah, I think it's quite clear that medical training consists of learning facts, because you can't read the original research on everything. And so you accept that everything you're told is true. And when there are weaknesses in what you're told, you may not be aware of that unless you do your own research, which I guess some doctors eventually do. Joan, do you have anything to say about scientific and medical supporters that were involved with your film or that you know of otherwise?
Well, I do, but going back further, we did a series for Channel 4 called Kilo Cure, and one of the films was produced by Jad Adams, who's written a book about AIDS, The Myth of HIV. And he produced this really powerful film called Whooping Cough, A Shot in the Dark. And I learned a hell of a lot then, because it was with Professor Gordon Stewart. He was the Professor Emeritus of Public Health at Glasgow University. He was very anti the whooping cough vaccine when it was in its raw form. And I actually was devastated. And we went to America, we met the lobby groups, we met the parents of severely brain damaged children. And I heard about Vera Duffy, who actually her book is over there about her son. And Jad actually looked into the whole argument around the herd immunity. And I think that our next step, if one is going to challenge people who criticize, for example, parents who don't vaccinate their children because they're going to infect others, I think we've really got to seriously look at the whole question of herd immunity. Because according to Jad Adams, because I actually wrote to him last week, he said, in order to achieve herd immunity, you need 90% vaccination. He says that really doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's all a myth, in a sense, that one can achieve herd immunity, because apparently 10% is not enough to start an epidemic. So I just, you know, was reminded of all the horrifying stories I heard, and the minimal compensation governments were giving for children damaged in the greater good. So that's what they were saying. So that's why I became alerted, right? And then Professor Duesberg, Peter Duesberg of Berkeley, California, and I worked very closely on the HIV/AIDS debate. And you, David, as chairman of Rethinking AIDS, know this background. He said one day, 20 years ago, You know, Joan, it's all wrong about the human papillomavirus. It's all wrong. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, no, he said, this is something we all live with. Our immune system deals with it. And now look what they're going to do. They're going to, you know, try and vaccinate the world. Well, soon after, Dr. Christian Fiala in Vienna actually mentioned that he was deeply concerned about the human papillomavirus. Actually, he wrote a paper with Professor Duisberg in which a young girl in Vienna had died, and she is mentioned in our film, of course. And she had died of autonomic disorders, you know, neurological disorders early on, very mild, but she died in her sleep of apnea. She lost the ability to breathe. And when he tried to stop the rollout of the vaccine in Austria...
You're talking about the doctor who when Christian Fiala tried to stop the rollout?
Yes, he did. Yeah. He campaigned strongly.
Okay.
Against the rollout. And he succeeded in stopping the government giving it to health authorities and health services free. But that has been overturned since. Mm. And he did in the film. So that's the history of how I became involved with the human papillomavirus. But the thing is, I was so shocked when I met a little girl called Mia, aged 11, the first person we were going to film. Andy Rees, the director of our film, and I went to this house in Berkshire, near London. And it was just the most horrifying moment, because I walked into this sitting room, and sitting at the end was a little 11-year-old girl strapped all the way up her arms and all the way down her legs to a wheelchair, leaning back with a neck brace, only able to move her lips. Oh. And I was devastated. Sadly, Mia could not appear in our film for legal reasons. But of course, we did have Ruby and Chloe, and we had Kristen from Australia, who were wonderful, but of course are severely damaged. You know? Mm-hmm. Chloe, to this day, since I met her, she's lost her ability to speak. She's very seriously ill. And if you'll allow me, because this is a moment when I feel I can actually quote you all the disorders that she had, that she was told were all in her head, right? These are now official medical diagnoses after her vaccination, a long time after, because they didn't believe her.
Right.
Which is why, you know, she wants people to be believed, and so does Ruby. She was diagnosed with POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, eosinophilic colitis, fibromyalgia, ME, gastroparesis, and mast cell activation disorder. And that, she was told, was all in her head.
Right, but now they've accepted that it's caused by the HPV vaccine.
No, they haven't. Nobody has written that down. She says, you know, they've spoken to doctors who've said they think it's to the vaccine. Nobody has written that on paper. Nobody. These are her official diagnoses.
Right. But it just came out of the sky. Like, if it didn't come from the vaccine, there must have been a cause.
And of course, David, and the main thing is that the mothers, you know, they know their daughters. They know were perfectly well until they had their first shot. And there are photos of the girls dancing, ballet, skating, beautiful girls, you know, but they're not believed.
That's almost as shocking as the damage that is done to them. I'd like to switch tracks and go back to Meryl and talk about, while we're in Australia, so to speak, talk about some Australian things. So in the political environment in Australia, are all the political parties rigidly pro-vaccine, even the little parties?
Some of the independents are not. When I say not, I think every person will be verbally pro-vaccination, but not every person is pro-coercive and discriminatory vaccination policies. But it is fairly well a united front across the major parties and the Greens. The Greens are quite surprising under a leader who's been leading them for the last 4 years or so, Dr. Richard Di Natale, not only have they become a pro-GMO and anti-choice on vaccinations, but they've also started to question whether nuclear energy might be a good thing. So,
wow.
I know. The thing is, I believe that Australia has descended into fascism. We have government protecting corporate interests at the risk of the public health. And
Before we go to the corporate interests, explain no jab, no pay.
Okay, no jab, no pay was passed in January 2016, enacted in January 2016. In Australia, like I think Canada has very similar policies, parents are given a parenting allowance. It's a tax benefit. It's a money off of their taxes to help them raise their children. It's means tested. So people who are above a certain income level do not get this payment. It's only people who are below a certain income level. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, they receive a percentage back on childcare because the government wants all parents to work. What no jab, no pay does is it removes completely the childcare benefit, which comes out to about $15,000 per child per year, so that parents who are below a certain income level can no longer afford to work, and parents have been forced into poverty. We have parents who have aborted much wanted children because they feel they can't afford them, parents who are living in their cars, parents who are only having dinner themselves 3 to 4 nights a week so they can afford to feed their children. It is shocking that in a country like Australia, which is supposed to be egalitarian, we have a situation where the government is actually penalizing those who are the most vulnerable, whilst those who can afford to say no to this money are not even affected. It is a disgusting situation.
Yes. And has anybody tried to take that to court? Because it seems...
We did. We spent over $50,000 on legal opinions from top QCs and barristers. And the issue is that the Australian Constitution could have been written on the back of a box of cornflakes. And we are, as far as I know, the only developed country without a Bill of Rights. So the government, what we have found is that the government is within their rights to discriminate against the population. And they can do that if they want. And obviously, that is what they want. Our Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, his wife, Lucy, was chairman of the board until recently of a company called Prima Biomed, which had strong interests in HPV vaccination. And her shares increased, according to reports in the Sydney Morning Herald, from a value of $750,000 to over $5 million after the passage of No Jab, No Pay.
And that's not a conflict of interest?
As well, the Premier of New South Wales was forced to resign because he didn't report that he received a bottle of wine from someone. And yet Malcolm Turnbull is still Prime Minister of Australia. So go figure.
Regarding no jab, no pay in the Australian mandatory vaccine situation, they're not taking money. They're taking the right to an education away, which seems like that would be unconstitutional. But so far, the state of California has got away with refusing school. And I guess it's the same thing. If you have money, you can send your children to a private school or you can homeschool them. But if you're poor, you basically have no choice and most people will succumb. I guess you can move out of the state. But you know, if you're poor, that's probably not an option either.
No, and one of the things that Alona, who helped to organize this tour, is involved with is a community that extends across Australia where parents have gotten together and they are helping each other. Now, I have to clarify, this is not school, this is preschool and childcare. So they are setting up their own preschool and childcare sharing situations so that parents can continue to work and so that children can have access to the early childhood education that should be everyone's right. If the government did this with school and they are talking about no jab, no school, then we would have a case to take against them. And I have to say that they are considering no jab, no school, no jab, no pension for the elderly, and no jab, no job. So our country is descending into an absolute tyranny when it comes to vaccination and medical issues.
And do you also have a rising rate of autism in Australia?
Yes, we do. According to Autism Australia, one child in 50 is now autistic. We don't have it split out like the United States with boys, but since the US says that one child in 68 is autistic, we believe Australia's rate is actually higher. And that could be because we don't know what the boys versus girls rate
right.
is. America does that. We don't.
Okay.
But we have added an extra dose of the MMR vaccine. The first dose is given at 12 months, the second dose at 18 months. So America does not do that, and we feel that that extra vaccine could be causing an increase in autism over and above what the U.S. is seeing.
So your vaccine schedule is similar. You've stated one difference, but in terms of the number of vaccines, is similar to the United States?
It is. We have 24 vaccines within the first 12 months. The U.S. has 26, I believe.
Okay, so virtually identical from a high-level viewpoint, pretty much the same. And this has been going up over time?
Oh, yes, very much. Two new vaccines look like they're going to be added to the childhood schedule in within a matter of weeks. The meningococcal B and the meningococcal ACWY, which is now being paid for by at least two states in Australia, but the federal government is being pushed to add that to the vaccine schedule and making it free for all Australian children. And ACWY has only been used for a short time in Tasmania, and there's already been one case of a child hospitalized with either meningitis or Kawasaki disease following the vaccine, and many other reports of serious reactions. But it doesn't matter how many people react, the government still pushes the vaccine.
So the carrot is you get these things for free, and the stick is that you get punished if you don't take them. What are the reasons for refusing vaccines in Australia? What are the major reasons people, even with all this coercion, still refuse vaccines?
I think they're the same reasons that parents everywhere use, and that is that they have done their research and they feel that the risks of vaccination far outweigh any potential benefits. And many parents, such as myself, don't even believe that there are benefits, because the entire basis behind vaccination, that antibodies will mean that you are immune, and all vaccines are meant to do is induce the production of serum antibodies, was proved over 70 years ago to be false, that you can have very high levels of antibodies and still be susceptible to disease.
I mean, when I was a child, which was a long time ago, I was told that vaccines were like natural immunity, that natural immunity generally lasted for a lifetime, not always, but most of the time. But now we see vaccines that are given two or three times, like HPV, I think it was given three times, and in some places it's dropped to two, but the idea is that one vaccine's not good enough, which indicates that it's not as good as natural immunity.
Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely. Mm. Yes, and this is, can I butt in here about...
Joan, you're still with us. Yeah, of course. Of course you can, Joan.
Thank you for the fact that because they have to give more jabs and raise your antibody levels, Professor Christopher Exley from Keele University, who is a world authority on aluminium toxicity, became concerned about the amount of aluminium that was going in to the HPV vaccine. So he points out in several scientific papers and personally in our film that these vaccinations, they were fast-tracked, Cervarix and Gardasil, and what happened was that they just went through phase one trials and then they were fast-tracked. But what he's discovered is that with Cervarix they added a lipid aluminium adjuvant to the aluminium hydroxide adjuvant, which was already there after the safety trials, right? After. And with Gardasil, they used a completely new aluminium adjuvant that had never been used before. And he worries about these things, and he believes that a lot more research has to go into that.
And some people would say, well, they used a placebo, so therefore, if there was a problem, we'd find it. But the problem with the vaccine placebos is that normally they are kind of a mock vaccine. So it's everything in the vaccine except the HPV or whatever the vaccine is for. So if there's aluminum in both the placebo and the vaccine, and there's side effects to aluminum, they'll be the same approximately in both arms, and they'll conclude that those side effects don't exist. Just by coincidence, a lot of people in both arms had adverse reactions.
Quite so, and Dr. Christian Fiala says that is cheating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it might be justified to have to do that if you have a third arm, which is a true placebo, because then you can see the impact of the biological agent, and then you can also see the impact of the other ingredients. But this creates the illusion that vaccines are safe, and you're right, it's cheating.
Actually, it's bias, David. And now I have one more thing I want to say here about bias.
Okay.
You know about the Cochrane. You know Cochrane.
Yes. I was going to ask you about that. Yes. So tell us about this.
A week ago, this came out in the British Medical Journal, right?
Yes.
And criticizing the Cochrane Institution for a review it made in which it said that there was no evidence. It claims of harm from the vaccine were unjustified and could damage public confidence. Okay. Now, those criticizing that Cochrane review are saying that the review fell short of Cochrane standards, left out a whole lot of trials altogether, and therefore that it failed to meet the needs of citizens and healthcare providers who rely on Cochrane reviews.
And aren't some of those critics actually members of the Cochrane Institute themselves, like Peter Gottschy? Is Peter Gottschy on there?
I'm not sure, because this was written by, in fact, an old colleague of mine called Nigel Holt. He wrote this article, but I'm not sure exactly of that. I have to look.
Yes, Peter Gottschy and Thomas Jefferson are both authors of that critical study, a critical report, and they are both Cochrane, I think, Scandinavia something.
Nordic Cochrane Institute. Yeah. I've interviewed Peter Gottschy on the issue of mammography. He's been very critical of a lot of mainstream medical procedures, and I think he wrote a book with a title that I think is like pharma is he compared it to the mafia.
Am I right in saying that Gottschy and Jefferson are being criticized in this?
No. I think they are criticizing the report.
I'm not sure because I wish Elizabeth Hart was with us, because really, I think they're criticizing Gottschy and Jefferson for their early review, and this is after that, but I would need confirmation.
Gottschy and Jefferson criticized the Cochrane review of HPV vaccines. They are saying that the Cochrane review of HPV vaccines was biased, inaccurate, and left out a lot of information. So Gottschy and Jefferson are saying that the Cochrane review is now under question because they published such a horrible study.
Right, and I remember talking to Peter Gottschy about mammography, and he said that another Cochrane Institute, I mean, there's lots of sort of outfits around the world that all are part of the Cochrane Institute. The one, I think maybe in Australia, was accepting corporate funding, which they're not supposed to do. And it was a bunch of radiologists basically wrote all these great things about mammography, which of course has a conflict of interest, which is exactly what Cochrane Institute's not supposed to do. So things like this could rip the institution apart. Supposed to be unbiased, evidence-based medicine. And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, but it should always mm-hmm. be that. I wanted to go to the tour itself. So either one of you, I guess Meryl, you were actually physically present. You probably know more about some aspects of it. So can you describe what kinds of reactions you got, where you went, if there's any new things that you learned, et cetera?
Well, we went to 7 different venues, from the Sunshine Coast, which is in Queensland, down to Melbourne, which is all the way down south in Australia. And at every venue, we asked women, or men too, to raise their hands if they had received the HPV vaccine. And then we asked them to raise their hands if they had reacted to the HPV vaccine. And the rates of reaction varied from between 50% as a low to 100%. So, yes. At one venue, we had 7 people who raised their hands that they had received the HPV vaccine, and 4 of them said they'd had serious reactions to the vaccine. So, I think that the HPV vaccine is probably the most dangerous one we have so far. Why that is, I'm not sure. If it's the high level of aluminium, if it's the combination of ingredients, if it's the polysorbate 80 carrying things to the brain, I don't know. But the fact is that it's given to adults, which makes it a whole lot more difficult to play the coincidence card, which is what happens with children. And Joan, I believe, like with Chloe and with Ruby, where they were told that their reactions were a coincidence, that is much easier to do. There is a latent misogyny, I think, in the medical community. And when women are claiming things, too often it's put down to hysteria or mental health issues. Mm-hmm. But we are starting to see numbers of boys and men reacting to this vaccine. And I think that it's going to be much more difficult to use that excuse.
I mean, it's been kind of unique that the HPV vaccine has been almost entirely given to young women, girls and young women. And now there's a push to get it to boys. And then I guess there'll be a catch-up program to give it to adults of both sexes. But I agree with you that there's probably more of this with women, but I think there's also, what do they call it? Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which is kind of blaming the parent, saying that the parent is imagining these symptoms, or even worse, the parent's actually causing the symptoms, which is very convenient for taking attention away from whatever the medical doctors did to the child through vaccines or drugs.
That's right. We have a researcher, Helen Hayward Brown, in Australia, who has done a lot of research into false accusations of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, and also shaken baby syndrome, which is another convenient excuse for the medical community to blame the parent for the harm that their treatment often causes. And it is adding crimes on crimes, because these poor parents are dealing with the deaths or injuries of their children, and then they often end up in prison for something they never did.
Yes. A new paper just came out of Canada. I assume you've probably both seen it, which kind of surprised me. It's sort of a feminist analysis of the HPV vaccine. And there's a little bit of sociological jargon here, but what it says is HPV vaccination campaigns are morally laden, gendered, heteronormative, and factually misleading. It talks about the lack of information of both the girls and their parents, The vaccine programs try to construct the mothers as responsible biocitizens at the cost of powerlessness, uncertainty, anxiety, and fear. They feel alongside the perceived imperative to act upon their daughter's cancer risks. Health professionals generally appropriate to take over dominant vaccination discourses and use fear of HPV vaccination as a strategy to manufacture consent for girls and parents. So I was a bit surprised to see this, because sticking your head up out of the trenches these days as an academic and saying you've got concerns about vaccines is a dangerous thing to do.
Yes, it's very dangerous. And we saw that on the tour. We had people who contacted us, doctors and academics, who wanted to come along to the screening, but they were afraid to, because they felt that if they were seen there, they might lose their license to practice medicine, or they might lose their tenure at the universities where they're working. There's such a strong effort to censor this information. This is not related, but the Western Australian group raised money to put up two billboards in Perth saying simply, do you know what's in a vaccine? And last night on the news media, it was said that they would be pulled down because we can't have this sort of dangerous anti-vax message in Australia. So, you know, there is such a strong effort to censor anything that even slightly questions vaccination. And because we don't have a constitutional right to freedom of speech, though we do have high court decisions that do guarantee freedom of political speech, the government gets away with silencing us.
Yes, and with such great conflicts of interest. And also, it reminds me of the United States. Like, if you are an American citizen who is opposed to war, you have a choice of voting for the Republican Party, which loves war, or the Democratic Party, which loves war. So you have no choice, basically. And it seems the same in Australia with vaccines. You can vote, I guess, Liberal and Labor are your two big parties, and you can vote Green, and they're all going to be telling you that you must be vaccinated. And if you're being coerced into it, it's for the greater good of society. And if your child is injured, if you're not imagining it, well, that's a small sacrifice to make for the health of the rest of the people. Okay. We have...
Can I say something?
Yes, we have a few more minutes left. So why don't we make our closing remarks?
I just want to add one more thing, because I'm terribly worried about the cover-up that's going on. And Steve Hinks of the AHVID in England, he and Frieda Birrell, they run a group called Association of HPV Vaccine Injured Daughters. Mm-hmm. They made it possible for me to make the film because they gave us all the contacts. I'm very grateful to them. Steve is a very solid researcher. He says that the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency in the UK report publicly that no serious risks have been identified associated with HPV vaccines. However, he then went to Freedom of Information, and through it, he was told there are 9,000 adverse reactions reported and 3,000 serious adverse reactions and 9 deaths. Well, we all know that very low reporting levels exist. You know, they say it's probably 1%. Now, how is it that publicly the regulatory agency that looks after us says there are no serious risks?
And nobody's holding them to account. Like, where are the politicians jumping up and down in the House of Parliament in England or America or Canada or Australia saying our public health agencies are lying? Recently in the United States, somebody took the government to court because supposedly the government is supposed to every year produce a report about what they've done in the area of vaccine safety. And in the 30 or so years that they've been mandated to do this, they haven't once produced this report. You'd think that would be a big deal, but it isn't. Meryl, we have a few minutes left. So what did you not get an opportunity to say?
Well, the one thing that I think is very important for everyone to know is that whilst the government and the media are pushing evidence-based medicine, they're not actually looking at the evidence. With the human papillomavirus vaccine, we are being told that it is wiping out cervical cancer around the world. But the actual fact is that where we can see evidence from countries like the UK and Sweden and Australia and the United States, we are seeing an increase in both cervical cancer cases and deaths in the age groups that are most likely to have received the vaccine, mm-hmm. whilst those in the older age groups who have not been vaccinated, we see the decline in cases and deaths continue unabated. So I'm not saying that there is proof that the vaccine is causing an increase in cancer deaths. If the rest of the world is doing what Australia is doing, they're actually not even using pap smears in that age group anymore. They're simply testing for evidence of HPV infection. So lack of pap smears, which led to this decline in cases and deaths, may be causing the increase. But the fact is that the vaccine is not causing a decline in cases and deaths. We are seeing an increase in that, and that needs to be attended to.
Well, there's been some very strong statements made about how the vaccine will eliminate cervical cancer. But in the early days of giving the vaccine, when, in as you said, in young people, the rate of cervical cancer is going up, then it's clearly not true that the vaccine is going to eliminate cervical cancer. And as you say, there could be a variety of reasons. It could be a direct effect of the vaccine. It could be changes in screening, which are causing more false positives, which are being recorded as real cases. It could be a chemical in the environment, perhaps a birth control or cosmetic or something else that's in the environment that's changed, that could be causing this. And nobody wants to know anything about anything but strains of HPV.
Exactly.
Yes, David. And also, if you just imagine that you are a woman that has early signs of cervical cancer, but no HPV, and you're only allowed to have a test these days for HPV, you would go undetected.
Yes, and I think that's true of a lot of screening tests. They all produce a lot of false positives, but they also miss a lot of cases of true cancer, which people get screened. They say, okay, I'm good for a year, I'm clean, but maybe the test just missed it.
Yes, but this is because these women are not doing the pap smear. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very reliable.
Yes, I hope to very soon interview the father of the PSA test, who has for 14 years at least decried the use of the PSA test to detect cancer, which is pretty amazing. There's so many problems with these screening systems, but which is laid on top of the problems with the vaccine. Mm. Anyway, I would like to thank both of you for joining me today about the rather exciting tour of Australia with Joan Shenton flying in remotely and Meryl actually being there. Thanks to the world of technology, it's pretty hard to create a censorship island. The borders of Australia cannot keep out the new Ned Kelly.
We're going to have to get you a helmet, Joan.
Yes.
Oh, right.
That's right.
Oh, I'm longing for the day when I hear that I have a visa.
Well, how about an invisibility cloak? Then you can just get on the airplane. Something like that. Well, hopefully in the future you'll get your visa and maybe you can do the tour again, actually in person this time.
We'd love that.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Meryl. Thank you, Joan. Appreciate you both joining me today.
Thank you, David.
Thanks. Bye.
I'd like to clarify one point of confusion during the show. Recently, the British Medical Journal, BMJ, published a news article about a Cochrane review of HPV vaccination published in May 2017. For those who don't know the Cochrane Institute, it's a large group of evidence-based medicine research centers. It's a mainstream organization that believes that by looking at the evidence without bias from corporate funding, the truth, or something close to it, can be arrived at. In this case, Lars Jorgensen and Peter Gottschy from the Nordic Cochrane Center in Copenhagen, and Tom Jefferson of the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine in Oxford, have criticized the Cochrane Review, which was the point of the BMJ news article. These researchers, despite being associated with the same organization, believe that only about half the available research was included, possibly reaching the wrong conclusion. The Cochrane Review included 26 studies involving 73,428 women, but according to these three critics, there are actually 46 trials including more than 120,000 women. Perhaps related, in January of 2018, these three published a paper in which they tried to index all the HPV vaccine trials, a job that was made considerably more difficult because only one of four HPV vaccine manufacturers provided information on the trials they'd been involved with. They also noted in this article that the European Medicines Agency and the FDA in the United States had also only used about half the trials during their approval of the vaccines. Reading between the lines, the implication is that they used the half that gave the best results, which is likely those with the most pharmaceutical funding. Complicating this issue is that in 2004, one of the authors, Tom Jefferson, wrote a paper that has been heavily criticized by some, entitled Adverse Events After Immunization with Aluminum-Containing DTP Vaccines, Systematic Review of the Evidence. The abstract of this paper, this wasn't even buried in the paper, included the rather stunning sentence, "Despite a lack of good quality evidence, we do not recommend that any further research on this topic, aluminum vaccines, is undertaken." Just think about it. If the author had said, despite a lack of good quality evidence on aluminum and vaccines, we found no evidence of ill effects, it would be rational, but it certainly wouldn't be a call to stop research. Since then, Jefferson has been rather defensive about this article, perhaps not surprisingly, but it was also 14 years ago, and sometimes the leopard can change his spots. Perhaps that's the case now. Hopefully, this clears up some of the confusion during the interview about who and what was being criticized. I've contacted Peter Gottschy about this, but no response yet. And lastly, if you have the time, I can recommend an article in The Atlantic, available at theatlantic.com, entitled The Nastiest Feud in Science, about a Princeton geologist named Gerda Keller, who, according to the article, has endured decades of ridicule for arguing that the fifth extinction was caused not by an asteroid, but by a series of colossal volcanic eruptions. But she's persisted over many years and has reopened the debate that appeared to be closed at one point. It's a really interesting discussion of dysfunctional science and how when a theory gets traction, it becomes political, and the aim of the game is to suppress your critics because there ends up being a lot of power in being the owners of an important theory. Everybody wants to have your papers. Everybody wants to give you grant funding. It's both money, power, and status. So this is a pretty good article of an issue that maybe doesn't have any direct relevance to our modern world. After all, if there's a future extinction from volcanoes or from a comet or a meteor, there's not much we can do about it. But it does give a really good insight into how modern science tends to work. Certainly not always, but certainly more often than it should be. Thank you for listening to episode 190 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.